Microphone today. It's Tuesday, February 23rd, 2010, and as members gather, the first thing on the agenda is a proposal from the Bush Foundation, and I'd like to welcome Peter Hutchinson, president of the Bush Foundation, Susan Hegard, we know Susan very well, former director of the Office of Higher Education, and they have a presentation for a very exciting and innovative project that the Bush Foundation is committed to, and we're going to hear about the project and what role we might be able to play. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Hutchinson. I'm the president of the Bush Foundation. With me today is Susan Hegard, your old friend, who's our vice president and team leader for educational achievement. And our other teammate is Julie Scholing over here, who's also a member of our education team. Our mission today is to share with you two things. One, the direction that we're taking as a foundation and how it relates to educational outcomes. And then secondly, some research we've done about some of the issues surrounding educational outcomes and some research about ways in which education finance can contribute to the ways in which we prepare teachers and so on. By way of quick background, the Bush Foundation is about 55 years old. It was founded by Archibald and Edith Bush. Archibald was James L. McKnight's partner in running 3M for pretty much forever. And we in Minnesota are lucky to be the recipients of these two great foundations, the McKnight Foundation and Bush. About 2.5 years ago, our board stepped back from the day-to-day work we were doing and focused on the question, what difference should we try to make as a foundation in the three states in which we operate, Minnesota, North, and South Dakota? And they decided there are three things we should focus on. Leadership is one of them. Another is the Native Nations. And the one we're here to visit with you about today is education. In the realm of education, they've challenged Susan and Julie and me to pull something off that's pretty tough. Increase by 50% the number of students in our three states that are on track to obtain a degree after high school. And they've given us 10 whole years to do it, and the resources of the foundation, which is the great gift. And we've made a commitment, a $40 million commitment to teacher preparation, because our research has suggested to us that although there are lots of factors that have influenced student outcomes, teaching matters, and it matters more than any other in-school variable. And so our focus is very narrowly on the next 25,000 teachers that will go into teaching in Minnesota, the ones that will replace the 25,000 teachers that will retire and leave teaching for whatever reason. And what we're really focused on is assuring that every one of those 25,000 teachers are the most effective they can be. Because I think, and as Susan will show you, the data suggests that if we were to succeed at such a thing, putting 25,000 fabulously effective teachers in front of our kids, things like the achievement gap, things like our worry about whether or not our kids are getting the kind of education they need, a lot of those things will be a lot better than if we don't. So Susan's job here today is to bring you up to date on our thinking, share with you the research we've done. My job is to run the PowerPoint.
Good morning.
Just a minute. Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hutchinson, I had a question on the leadership part of your priorities. Does any of that involve education as well? Because, you know, there's a great deal of research saying a highly effective leader principal who recruits and retains those teachers is a key part of that strategy. And so do you link that?
The short answer is yes.
Mr. Hutchinson.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, we have the short answer is yes. We haven't rolled that piece out. So think of it as a coming attraction, but it's definitely a coming attraction.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Hegard, proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. So our first slide, can we just click to the first? There we go. Teacher effectiveness, as Peter mentioned, matters more than any other school variable. Lots of things matter: after-school enrichment programs, the class size, the curriculum, but of all the factors that we looked at in our research, teaching really matters the most. And one of the most exciting things I think that's happening right now is the stars are really aligned. The Obama administration and Secretary Duncan through Race to the Top, the Gates Foundation and other foundations are very focused on effective teachers and teaching. And our governor was the chair of the Strategic Management of Human Capital Task Force that was funded by Carnegie and the Gates Foundation. So lots of national and international attention now focused on teaching. There's clear evidence that students placed with the most effective teachers progress 3 times faster than those placed with the least effective teachers. And it's very, very critical to closing the achievement gap. On this slide, you can see here, this was a study that was done by Saunders and Rivers out of Tennessee, but there's similar data that we'd see out of Dallas and Boston. And in Minnesota, you know, we're trying here through their foundation's work to close the achievement gap. As you know, we have one of the biggest achievement gaps in the country. And a student who has the chance to have an effective teacher, look at the difference, you know, in the gap there. They can increase by 53 percentile points. This was a math assessment that was done in Tennessee. And the fabulous thing is that they can catch up. The really disappointing thing is that if the student doesn't have a chance to have an effective teacher, there can be long-lasting, permanent damage to that student. So teaching really matters. On the next slide, you'll see that we've committed to partnering with 14 institutions in the three-state area. The Bush Foundation works in North and South Dakota and Minnesota. And these institutions have all committed to producing at least 25,000 effective teachers within the next decade. As Peter mentioned, that's the number that will retire over that same period of time. We've made a $40 million commitment over the 10-year period. That's the largest commitment the foundation's ever made. And what we're doing is we're funding the transformation. So on the slide, you can see that there's a partnership consortium up in the Fargo-Moorhead area. That's Moorhead, part of the Minscu system, NDSU, and Valley City. Valley City in North Dakota already had a partnership, we're really excited about their work with these three institutions. St. Cloud State University, Minnesota State University Mankato, USD in Vermilion, the U of M, consortium of private colleges in the Twin Cities area. There are 6 institutions that are part of that consortium: St. Thomas, St. Kate's, Bethel, Concordia, Augsburg, and Hamline. That's right. And then Winona State University. And actually, Sally Standiford is somewhere in the corner here, or she was here. She's the dean at Winona right now. Thanks for being here, Sally. As part of this commitment, the universities are guaranteeing that their graduates will produce at least 1 year's worth of growth in each student on average, including all, and that includes all student subgroups, English language learners, free and reduced lunch, et cetera. And, you know, we decided that we'd aim for at least 1 year's worth of growth. Some folks think that's too much. Some folks don't think that it's enough. And so we probably are positioned at just about the right place. To support the transformation of these programs, we and our partners are focusing on improvements in 5 core areas: teacher preparation, program development, and that's the recruitment, preparation, placement, and support of teachers. And I'll talk about that in a little more detail in a moment. Long-term financing for improved teacher preparation. So looking at the financing around the program, the programs themselves, the state financing and other financing. Tools, tests, and tools to enable teachers to look at their individual and program measurement of students. We're looking at teacher career value proposition and enhancement, looking at compensation. And what role that plays into attracting and retaining teachers. And we're also looking at a marketing campaign across the 3 states to attract and retain the strongest candidates to teaching careers. So this is very courageous work. It's hard to do, and it's hard to do without an economic challenge, and it's really hard to do without a budget crisis. So I don't know if it's triply or quadruply hard right now, but it's really hard to do. So these universities are committing to transforming the way they recruit, prepare, place, and support new teachers. And this will require them to partner with P-12 districts and schools on design, delivery, and continuous improvement of their programs. And this slide, I think, illustrates nicely the 4 areas that we're focusing on. So it's not just one, it's 4. In recruitment, asking, and the universities are agreeing to become more intentional in the way that they target students who are most likely to succeed in teaching, looking at the higher academic profile, those with an orientation to making a difference, who are ambitious and seek intellectual stimulation. We want also to increase the focus on high-need disciplines such as math and science and student diversity. That's very, very important. Right now we're producing, for example, a lot of teachers in the elementary education area. We need to look at supply in the area of high school and then more specifically math and science. In the area of preparation, the universities are focusing more on college, on the instruction in the K-12 classroom as opposed to the traditional college classroom instruction. So really tipping this thing more towards experiential learning and also requiring rigorous content knowledge with support from the arts and sciences faculty at the universities. In terms of placement in districts, this also needs to become more deliberate. These universities have agreed to partner with their districts and schools to guarantee placement upon graduation. These universities are committed to partnering with P-12 school districts that will maximize the likelihood of the graduates' effectiveness. And this really places the onus on the districts to create positive environments where quality teachers will want to work. And I think, Senator Wieger, this gets to your point, which is we need to also look at leadership. So making sure that there's positive, effective leadership at the school site is a critical aspect of the work here.
Madam Chair, do you want us to hold on questions?
No, I think it's okay if you want it, if it's appropriate right now. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hegard, can you give us an idea how many students you anticipate to graduate from the program, and then how many would likely be placed in Minnesota schools, and then what percentage of that would be the market share of teachers in Minnesota?
Ms. Hegard.
Senator Pappas, Senator Wieger. We've said 25,000 teachers is our goal, and so in the proposals that we received from the institutions, they all committed to various numbers of students that they'll graduate, ranging from about 100 per year to 1,000 per year, with the average being around 400 to 500 students at an institution. And so that all rolls up to 25,000 over a 10-year period of time. And that's about half of the teachers in the three-state area.
So just to clarify,
Madam
Chair, Ms. Hegard, about half of the teachers in Minnesota will have matriculated through your program.
That's correct.
That's correct, Senator Wieger, given the numbers that we have and the research that we've done, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
This might roll back a little bit, but I'm kind of processing as we're talking. This sounds like quite a commitment from the academic institutions. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, we've got some of the leadership there. Can you tell me, are the institutions, especially the U and MinSCU as a broader organization, are they committed at the top levels, the boards of trustees and regents or the presidents or chancellor? And is it that formalized that they are backing what you're doing, or is it not quite that formal?
So, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, that's a great question. So one of the things that we required in these proposals that we received from the institutions was leadership from the top, the president, the board, provost, as well as from the dean and the faculty. And so in all cases, we've met with the MinSCU board several times. Vice Chancellor Baer is here. We've met with her several times. We've talked with the chancellor, and we've met with the presidents also at the institutions from MinSCU who are participating in the program. Same thing with the university. We've met with President Brunix, with Provost Sullivan, and we've talked with leadership at the university also about this, because it can't be successful unless there's also support from the leadership of the system heads.
So, same with the private.
Senator Latz.
And so they, as institutions, are committed to making the kind of changes in their programs that you're describing here today?
Ms. Hegard.
Senator Latz, that's correct. That's what they've told us, and they've committed to. We have letters of commitment that we have signed from the leadership at these institutions.
Okay, why don't you proceed? Mr. Hutchinson.
Senator Latz, just to build on that, it is exactly the issue, right? These are huge changes, and the courage of these leaders to do this is the thing that has encouraged us the most, because when we started this, which was almost 2 years ago, we were seeking out those courageous leaders who would be willing to take on this kind of challenge. Mm-hmm. And in every single case, the question that we raised with them was, are you prepared to make the changes necessary so that you would be prepared to guarantee that your graduates would succeed in our classrooms? And that's the ultimate test for them, is whether they'd actually stand behind those graduates. And every one of them, up to the president, have been willing to say yes and consistently say yes as the, frankly, as the challenges have gotten a little tougher and a little tougher. They have not backed away.
Okay. All right. Why don't you proceed?
Thanks. And then finally, in terms of support, this is sort of a new area for the higher ed institutions, but it's a really critical area. Under the initiative the universities are committing to and have an opportunity to provide greater support for their graduates as they embark upon their teaching careers. And so they're looking at such things as individualized mentorship, professional development, and the districts will reinforce this by adding additional support through professional development practices of their own. So we're really looking for a true knitting together, a partnership between the school district and higher ed institution when it comes to the professional development of the teacher. Each of these partners has committed to providing at least 3 years of support. So we'll no longer have situations where the alumni office is the only entity on the campus who knows where the students have gone. Programs themselves will have a close relationship with these graduates as they move forward. And then they'll also have data that will feed back to the program that they graduated from to be able to improve that program where necessary.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hegard, will there be growth model data on student progress?
Ms. Hegard.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, so we're looking at value-added assessment as the tool. We're working with an outfit, I'll get to that in a moment, but a group out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Value-Added Research Center, headed by a man named Dr. Rob Meyer. And he's been working in Chicago and Milwaukee and New York City on similar initiatives, but looking at a value-added assessment tool that the teachers can use for student improvement.
And
Mr. Hutchinson.
Senator Wieger, one of the important connections here is to be able to connect student achievement with individual teachers and then back to the preparing institution. And again, another courageous thing for these institutions to do is to not only welcome that, but want it, but see it as a very important part. And what Susan has described as our work with the Value Added Center is very intimately connected with the development that's going on the campuses right now. They're building that into their own program so that their graduates will be intimately familiar with this approach to assessment and that the faculty will be interested in the data that is produced.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. The University of Minnesota or other Minnesota college or university didn't have something comparable to value-added? You had to go to Wisconsin?
Is that rhetorical?
Well, unless there's an answer.
Well, the short answer is that people in Wisconsin have a long track record, a well-established database, and the skills and capabilities. They were a logical group for us to go to. They're actually working with many individual school districts in Minnesota. And so it wasn't just that they were in Wisconsin. They're actually working here today.
Thank you.
Okay. And I might add, Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, that they are working on the ground here with Dave Heisted, who you may know from the Minneapolis School District. They have a long working relationship with Dave and some others here in the state and some research folks at the university. So we're all getting along very well so far.
University of Minnesota is probably doing this for Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll have to ask them.
So Minnesota currently makes a significant investment in teacher education. But one of the things our research has told us is that there's some misalignment in the incentives. And this has contributed to teacher oversupply and turnover, some lower academic achievement, and remediation of students. This particular slide, I can't read my notes right now, sorry. This particular slide shows the overproduction point. Schools of education are producing more than twice as many teachers than are in classrooms after 5 years. So if you look at this first column, this is data from the Minnesota Department of Education from 07 and 09. And the first column shows that there were 4,201 teacher license candidates prepared in our state. The second column then shows that of those individuals, new teachers hired, there were 2,714. And then if you look at the third column there, out of that group, 1,900 teachers are projected to remain by 2012. So roughly 30% leave within 5 years. And some of those individuals probably ought to, but there are many folks we believe are leaving who ought to be retained and are wonderful teachers.
When I met with these folks in my office and they told me 30%, I actually thought it was 50%. So I was pleased. But 30% is still a high number.
And then, you know, to get back to the point we talked about earlier, the supply and demand issue, if you look inside of that at, you know, the numbers of teachers who prepared who are elementary teachers, the numbers of people who are prepared who are for math and science, there's also a mismatch when it comes to supply and demand, too. Given to current turnover rates, the schools are producing, like I said, roughly 55% more teachers than the number that are likely to remain in the system after 5 years. On the next slide, this just looks at the student profile. These are SAT scores, and knowing that the ACT is the test that most folks take in the state, the SAT is probably about 10%, 11% of the population, but it's still illustrative. We were able to get this particular data and research. If you look at the intended major and SAT scores, the student profile of education programs is lower than that of other academic disciplines. And so an important aspect of the work we're trying to do is to make sure that we're attracting energetic, enthusiastic, well-qualified individuals to the profession. The conversation at the dinner table ought to be, you know, not why on earth would you want to be a teacher, but fabulous, you know, you're choosing to be a teacher. Can't think of anything, you know, that would be better to do. Minnesota government spent approximately $64 million on recruiting, preparing, placing, and supporting teachers. And this is the best, these are the best numbers we could come up with. We're certainly open to other numbers, to your input and suggestions, but this particular slide shows the state appropriation attributed to enrollment in schools of education per year. And our folks, we worked with some folks at the University of Minnesota, at MinSQ. We looked at the state grant program. At an average of K-12 new teacher induction and recruitment costs, and that's how we came up with our total of $64 million. And so, you know, the overall question really is, you know, given this substantial investment in preparation, are we getting the impact that this investment deserves?
Madam Chair?
And this doesn't include tuition. It's just state money.
It's just the state dollars.
It's just the state appropriation, Madam
Senator Chair. Latz.
I believe it's.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wieger.
Thank you.
I'll ask something if you want.
Chair, Ms. Hegard, where would early childhood teachers be reflected?
Ms. Hegard.
Madam Chair, just a moment.
They're not in this data.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, they're not in this data.
Okay.
Someday?
Someday.
And then another important point is that despite the training received in education programs, districts are bearing significant costs to train in new teachers. That's on the next.
That's on this one.
That's on this slide as well. Yeah, that was the point that, you know, in addition to the investment that's being made into higher education, there's a significant cost being borne by K-12 districts. And again, another great place for K-12 and higher education to come together. One example on the next slide of how a particular country has addressed this challenge is in the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, the Teacher Development Agency, called the TDA, serves as an example for how to align incentives in long-term financing to university performance in order to produce higher quality results in teacher effectiveness. This was an effort that was started under Margaret Thatcher and continued under Tony Blair. Prior to 1993, educational resources in the United Kingdom were allocated on a per-student basis with no link to performance. That's what it looked like on the left, fairly similar to the way that we allocate funding in our state and in our country. When the funds flow reform was implemented, it did not dramatically change the funding levels at all for teacher preparation programs, but rather the funds were reallocated through a central standard authority and based upon performance. And today's TDA has contributed significantly to increasing the capacity, competitiveness, and quality of teaching in the United Kingdom. And this last slide is just reflects that very point. It raised the teaching profession's capacity, so the number of teachers that were in the system, the competitiveness of the teachers, those graduating from the top universities, the mix of institutions that were producing teachers, and then also the capability of teachers, those graduating with more competitive degrees. All of those things improved under their initiative. And another really interesting thing that we took a look at was their marketing efforts, and they had some wonderful nationwide marketing ads and campaigns that they looked at to try to attract different people to the profession. New teachers, some of them were mid-career, some of them were just out of high school, but they really, really saw a turnaround both in the individuals they recruited and then also in the outcomes that were produced for the students in K-12.
Were they able to connect the dots then with student achievement?
Madam Chair, our understanding is that they were. Their assessments then were able to be tied back, and they gave that information back to the institutions that they graduated from.
Then was there an overall, the academic achievement level of the students then overall increased?
And we've got a fairly thick report back here. I'd be happy to make that available to you, but a lot of that information's in the report.
Because that's the ultimate goal.
That's correct.
Right. Senator Latz.
Ms. Hegard, Mr. Hutchinson, you're proposing to spend $40 million on this, and you've shown us a chart about how the UK handled their funding flows. How do you propose to actually spend the $40 million?
So, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, so the $40 million that we're spending is going almost all of it directly to the institutions of higher education. A portion of it's going to fund the value-added research work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But the bulk of the money is going directly to the institutions. And as I said, we're not funding operations. We're funding the transformation of the program. So they're looking at different recruitment approaches. They're looking at very different approaches to how they prepare the teachers. For example, some are looking at a residency model that might have much more and looking at different approaches to student teaching. So the student teaching experience might come earlier and last longer than the traditional approach that's taken today. In terms of placement, funds could be spent to enhance that relationship with K-12, building that relationship with their K-12 partners, whether they pick one or five or 10 partners. And then the support piece will also probably cost money, trying to build the support for the teacher, the professional development for the teacher once they finish the program. So we're not telling them how to spend the $40 million. It's really up to them, and we're holding them accountable, and they're holding themselves accountable for outcomes. We're not getting into sort of the front-end curriculum and what that ought to look like. I think our time is better spent on the back end, which is measuring and results and then also helping them get to their intended outcomes.
So I assume, you have, like, a guideline. They're academics. They're going to use research-based strategies for how they're going to transform, and it's just what you've allowed them to free up some staff time or bring in some consultants or whatever to help with the transformation process. Might be interesting to hear from some of the
Madam Chair, that's
deans,
absolutely right. And as I mentioned,
I'm sure you're in a very early stage of this, right, Dean?
Oh, and we have the dean from the St. Cloud here as well.
Oh, wonderful. Welcome. Did you want to complete your question?
Thank you. So who is deciding how much money is going to each institution? How does that to work?
Is he gone?
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, so that was a combination of, in their proposal, they requested a certain amount of funding, and then we looked at our resources as a foundation. We have a certain payout limit every year, so we had to look at our overall resources over the 10-year period and then look at the yearly payout and come to a number that would work for us and for them.
So excuse me.
Mr. Hutchinson.
It's really keyed. We've already made the commitment. The institutions know what our commitment is to them, and they know the timing of that commitment. The scale was a function of two things. Everybody pretty much got sort of a core amount because redeveloping curriculum and redesigning program and so on is a pretty common thing. And then the only other variable was the size of their commitment in terms of the students that they're going to prepare. So an institution prepared to prepare 1,000 students is getting more resources from us than one that's committing to 100 or 200. And they're deep in it. They're deep in the process of rethinking what should that program look like, what sort of students should we be attracting, what pool should we recruit from, what should the path to teaching be, and I think most excited, what does the support system look like after graduation? Because it the tradition is you graduate with a degree and you go out and go to work and you really have limited contact with the sending institution. And the big commitment here is that the higher ed institutions, the teacher prep programs, are making a commitment to follow those graduates into their teaching career and support them for 3 to 5 years to assure that they will be effective in our classrooms.
So you picked so many colleges. Was it 14? I forgot the number, 11, something 14. Like that.
That's 11 correct. In Minnesota.
11 in Minnesota. And that's including the private colleges are counted as individually or as one?
There's seven proposals. So 2 of the 7 are consortiums, and then 5 are standalone institutions.
And how much competition did you have for this money? Other teacher ed schools, we have more. We have Bemidji. We have Duluth.
Yeah, Madam Chair, there are roughly 11 programs in North Dakota, 11 programs in South Dakota, and 33 in Minnesota. So, you know, one of the challenges is just trying to decide, you know, do you spread your resources thinly and include everyone? You know, our decision was just we would not be able to have impactful, deep change if we approached it that way. So we did narrow the focus. But the great hope, I think, is that some of the best practices and things that our programs are learning from one another will then be shared with others.
Senator Lass.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hegard, so how are you monitoring the methodology by which the institutions are going to be transforming their programs?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Letts, that's another great question. So right now we're trying to put the final touches on memorandums of understanding. So they all signed letters of commitment with us. We both signed them. And now we're working on a memorandum of understanding. And that memorandum, there's some legal, you know, mumbo jumbo in there. No offense.
I'm taken. I'm good at writing legal mumbo jumbo.
But then what it really lays out, there's an important part, is what happens if, we want to unwind. One of us does, one or the other, or both of us want to unwind. There's a process, of course, built in there for that. And then we lay out our own milestones and goals for the foundation. So what are the things that we're committing to? We're committing to providing resources. We've committed to providing coaching for these institutions. We've got an advisory group from experts from across the country. We're providing value-added assessment tools and other supports. Then they're going to have institution-specific milestones that they've decided themselves that make sense in the four areas: recruitment, preparation, placement, and support. Then there'll be some milestones that cut across all the institutions, because we want to be able to look at measurement and progress across all the 14 institutions and 7 proposals. So milestones, and we'll do a twice-a-year look at the milestones with our partners, and that's how we'll measure progress over time.
Senator Letts.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No, don't apologize. We've got time.
So it sounds like you're leaving it entirely in the hands of the institutions, however, to decide which changes in their programs they think would be most likely to lead to the results that you're looking for. And they're going back and looking at the studies, looking at what happened in the UK, looking what happened in other academic investigations around the country or wherever, and deciding what techniques or strategies or methods they think they want to implement at U or at St. Kate's or wherever.
Yes.
Is that entirely in their hands, or are you setting any standards for evidence-based changes or anything like that?
Madam Chair, Senator
Lantz,
when we started the process, we were simply looking for schools willing to be courageous. But to get to where we are today, they had to go through a pretty tough 18 months. And what Susan did is she assembled a panel of 8 experts from around the country who've actually done this work, who've been in the trenches, have they read all the evidence, they've actually written some of it on all these various dimensions about recruiting and the preparation and the placement and the support. And their proposals had to get through those eight geniuses before the foundation was prepared to make a commitment to them. So it wasn't our judgment alone, and you know, we're really, really smart, but we're not that smart. These eight experts were incredibly helpful, and lest we not leave you clear about this, not every school that started this process finished it. It just were programs that didn't have all the ideas, hadn't looked at all the evidence, weren't capable of delivering the kind of execution we were looking for. And so we're pretty confident that the proposals that we've chosen to fund are ones that are evidence-based, that are built around sound methodologies, that are more likely than other choices to put the institutions in a position to not only graduate good teachers, but to be able to stand behind those teachers for 3 to 5 years after they've graduated. This is an unprecedented commitment by an institution to actually be willing to stand behind those. So they got a young person that's in a classroom and they're not succeeding. The higher education institution feels responsible and will intervene and will be coaching and mentoring directly using their faculty. This is unprecedented as far as we know anywhere in the country, much less, we're not sure about the whole world, but it hasn't been done before. They have, you know, so it's this duality. They have to have confidence they've got the right plan because otherwise they're going to be in a ton of trouble. And our experts had to be convinced, and they were. And it was tough, grueling sessions that folks had to go through.
Ms. Teagarden and Mr. Hutchinson, the last two slides talk about, you know, the UK and the public money and the state money. Would you explain a little bit about your proposal? Because I think what you've talked about so far has been mostly negotiating with higher ed institutions, and you're bringing money to the table. Now you're talking about a different flow of money from how the state legislature funds education. And I think this might be, you know, this is a very difficult part of your proposal.
So what we're sharing is your research. Our research, we have to be careful. We're a foundation. We don't actually have a proposal.
Oh, I'm sorry. You don't have a proposal. A possible proposal.
We have data for you. So that what this slide was telling us, and at least what the research showed us, that the state dollars is spending about $64 million bucks a year. And the question that it raised for us was, and I think Senator Lass has been asking the right kind of questions, we're going to invest $40 million of our foundation resources in this transformation, but in fact we're spending $64 million a year, and that's not including the tuition, on teacher preparation. So the longer, bigger question is, what's the incentive structure? Is it reinforcing the kind of quality outcome, or isn't it? And what we learned from the UK was that it really does matter how the money flows. So this is not a question of how much as it is about how the money flows. And as you know, today you appropriate, generally speaking, lump sums to the two big institutions, and they figure it out. And the UK was doing exactly the same thing. And what they did is they took that amount of money, the resource that was committed to teacher preparation, out of that system and put it in a different system and said to the preparing institutions, the way that you access these resources is to demonstrate you can produce effective teachers. And over the last, well, it started, as Susan said, it started with Thatcher and Blair continued it. So over the last 6 or 7 years, that just that change in the money flow has transformed teacher preparation in the UK. They didn't have a Bush Foundation investing dough into the institutions in advance of that policy change. They made the policy change, and then the institutions had to scramble to figure out how to deliver. And what's intriguing to me is, oops, they figured it out. They're producing significantly better teachers today than they were 6 or 7 years ago without the Bush Foundation. And so, you know, my trustees might be asking, well, why in heaven's name are you making all this investment? Isn't it the right thing to do for the state to consider changing its policies? Now, that's a decision you all need to make. But what they did in the UK is they literally, in these terms, they would have moved the $64 million into this teacher development agency. And they said to this agency, you don't get to train teachers. You don't get to place teachers. You get to decide who will. And we're going to hold you, the agency, accountable for the quality of the teachers that are actually produced. So they worried a lot about recruiting. They ran the first ever nationwide recruiting program in the United Kingdom, and they dramatically altered who goes into teaching. One of the pieces of research was that for people who are already in careers, if they were asked, would you ever change careers, And if so, what career would you like to change to? They were given a list of 150 possible careers, and teaching came in number 92. 3 years later, teaching was number two. They just through a very sophisticated marketing plan, changed the community's expectations about teaching as a career and raised the level of support for it around the community. So they've dramatically altered who chooses to go into teaching, and then by changing the incentive structure, they've changed the quality of the teachers that are being produced. And yes, they are getting better test scores as a result. So this looked to us like a piece of research that was worth sharing, because it does demonstrate, we think, that how money flows is as important, is probably even more important than how much there is. And you're already committing the $64 million, so I think the question is, are you satisfied that you're getting the results that you'd like? And if not, are there other ways to reallocate those dollars, not to change the amount, but to change the incentives?
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hager, Mr. Hutchinson. You're just starting to touch on some of the points I was wondering that, in terms of the UK, some of the drill down details. But I just had three questions off the top of my head here. How has the UK dealt with, and this is more of a conceptual thing, the difference between individual goals for your own education and preparing a workforce for the state? Because there are people who will want to major in a particular area that this group of people may say, well, we don't want you, or we're not going to accept you into the program. And then you really have a body of people in the state or the nation deciding who gets to be a particular profession. So that's one question. Then you were just starting to address a little bit of another area I was concerned about. Did they do any follow-up with the students who've dropped out of education over the 5 years as to why they dropped out? Because that would significantly change how you address that. And then the last thing is, and I'm not sure if this is a trend in the UK as well, but we've heard it over and over and over here at the Capitol, that the employment trends for the future with this group of young people seem to be indicating that they're going to be changing professions anywhere from 7 to 10 to 14 times in their lifetime. How does that coalesce with this kind of structure where you're looking for long-term teachers?
Three very good questions.
So on the first, we're going to divide the questions up. So on the first question, which is really about, I think it was fundamentally about who decides who gets to be a teacher. In the UK, it works pretty much the way it works here. So it's not this central agency deciding. The programs, the schools, are still deciding who to admit, the same way we do today. So I don't think that's any different. What is different is who's applying. They've really changed who's applying, who's choosing this as a career, and that's their theory, which I am inclined to subscribe to, is that the big change is who decides to come in. If you get the folks most likely to be great at teaching to want to be teachers, you're more likely to get great teachers coming out the other end.
Ms. Hager.
To your second point on follow-up with students who dropped out, you know, I'm not certain. I have not snuggled up completely with this report here, but I don't know if they covered the question on follow-up of students who dropped out and why. I know that.
Did you mean in the UK? Did you mean here? Why
no,
students
actually,
drop out of teaching?
Anywhere. If we're looking at trying to solve that problem, we have to ask why people aren't working.
So one of the things we've done some research that we're still kind of working through of potential teachers and existing teachers 0 to 5 years. Looking at their preferences and some important factors regarding their attraction to teaching and whether they would choose teaching. We noted, though, in our research that we've got the 30% and we don't know why people are leaving, and we really need to dig into that. We don't have data and research about that particular thing yet, so we know that that's important. Again, you know, some of them, it's probably a good thing. They've decided that's not the right profession for themselves, but for the 20 or 15 or 25% of those who really wanted to stay in, but it hasn't been a fit for whatever reason, We need to figure out why that is. So that's something that we're very interested in learning more about. Your next question on employment trends with this new generation, I think that's a great point. I mean, that's what we've been hearing also. You know, one of the questions I have when I look at that data is that because the jobs are changing, that these young people are having to jump jobs so often, or is it a choice? You know, if they were presented with a career option that provided variation and was exciting and interesting and that sort of thing, would they choose to stay? I don't know. Do you want to add anything?
Well, I'm back on the second question for just a second. There is some research that has been done around the country on why it is that people who go into teaching don't stay, and there are three principal reasons, not in order of importance. One is compensation. People figure out that this is
hard work.
Maybe I can't earn all that I would like. Some people, as Susan said, do figure out, I actually don't like this. I thought I would, but once you're in charge of a whole classroom all by yourself, maybe that doesn't seem as much fun. And the third, which gets to Senator Wieger's question, is a pretty important number of people leave teaching because they don't like the environment in which they find themselves. They don't like their boss. They don't like the culture in their building or whatever reason, and they don't see a way out. And that's one that's susceptible to change. The issue about compensation is something we're studying right now. We have we're doing a lot of field research to try to understand what are the compensation choices. And this relates to your third point, which is we're doing this research with today's college students. So we're trying to get an understanding about what this generation thinks about when it thinks about a career like teaching, and what are the trade-offs that they're making in their minds as they think about teaching versus other careers. And we'd be happy to share that with you when that data is available. It's not ready yet. We're still processing
it. Those are great questions.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those three points, why teachers quit, sounded a lot like why politicians quit. But I don't know if somebody's asked you this question already, because I did walk in a little bit late. And so How were high-performing teachers distinguished between low-performing teachers?
No, that wasn't asked. Good.
This happened to be in Tennessee, and Saunders is was the creator of what's called value-added assessment. So they're measuring how much students in classrooms progress. So the highest 20% are the teachers that were able to deliver the most movement for their students, and the bottom 20%. Were the contrary, able to produce the least movement forward for their students, regardless of where their students started from.
I would think that the quality of the student that the teacher would make a difference also.
Right. So were they using? Were they judging the same type of student body? The same, maybe the same building, or the same type of leadership in the building?
These are matched samples. So the student variable is not the variable that's taken out of the. These are comparable students in comparable classrooms. So it's not just that all the high performing students are in the same building with all the same teachers. And Dallas is even a better example, but where the same data produces the same result, or Boston, the same data produces the same result, it is actually measuring the impact of the teacher on students, regardless of who the students are.
And so, Madam Chair, were the results based on some kind of test that the students were given periodically through the year, and they were given the same tests, and that's how it worked?
And in this particular example, I'm sorry.
All right.
In this particular example, this is testing mathematics over 3 years. So it's like we do. It's, you know, you take the math test at the end of the year, and they're just tracking how are these students doing, and what they're doing is following those students that get top 20% teachers every year and following those students that get bottom 20% teachers every year.
So is there any...
Mr. Tomasoni. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there any correlation then between... the high-performing teachers that you're talking about, and then the quality of the teachers that you think should be admitted into the teaching programs in the colleges. Is there any way to figure out a consistency there? I mean, is there a way of teaching, a way of thinking, a background that they come from? I don't know. Is there some kind of? I mean, how do you figure it out?
There's
Mr. Hutchinson.
I'm sorry. There's a lot. You got it. That's the key question.
How do you figure
and,
it out?
And here's what we know so far. And there's been a lot of research done. First, in, just in terms of things like SATs and ACTs, there is a correlation. It's not hugely powerful, but there's a correlation between your verbal ACT score or a verbal SAT score and your success in terms of being a top 20% teacher. There seems to be a correlation between the similarly on GPAs. There also seems to be a correlation between your orientation. So if you're in our research, we divide the world into change makers and altruists and reputationists and security seekers and mercenaries. We didn't make up those terms. But as you can imagine, change makers, if you think about who's on campus and who's making stuff happen, it's the go-getters. Those attitudes, those orientations seem to produce better outcomes in classrooms for all kinds of kids. And so there's both sort of these statistical relationships, but also these sort of attitudinal orientations that seem to be related. What we don't have is sort of the perfect diagnostic tool that would say, you know, if there's a young Tomasani that comes along, we can know whether or not that will be a great teacher. So the second piece
The second piece is,
and we see it in the proposals from the institutions, they want their freshman students that are in teacher preparation to be in front of students immediately. Because the best way to know who's going to be a great teacher is to see what they do when they're actually in a teaching situation.
And Madam Chair, one last question about the teachers. You gave three pretty good reasons for why teachers quit, but one of the reasons they don't quit is because they've been there so long that they've built up a certain retirement or they've built up a legacy or whatever it is. And is there any indication that the low-performing teachers are some of the ones that have been there the longest who maybe are tired of the job and need a break? Or, I mean, is there anything like that? I can remember a teacher that I had once said to me 25 years later, I asked him how he's doing. He said, I'm just waiting to get out of here. Now, I don't know if the level of his instruction went down, and I don't know if he was even better than he was when I had him, but, you know, I'm just wondering if the quality of the teacher has anything to do with the amount of time that they're there.
Again, the data is pretty clear that in the first 7 to 10 years, the answer is yes. That is, teachers get better every year up through the 7th and 10th year in terms of these kind of measures. And then they seem to achieve their peak, and they stay pretty much at that peak throughout their career. So after that, there is no real correlation after about the 10th or 15th year between longevity and student outcomes. So no, I wouldn't say that the data suggests that longer-serving teachers are less effective. They're as effective as they were 10 or 15 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Or as ineffective as
or,
they were.
Right, they're kind of wherever they got to.
Okay, can you I'm sorry, Senator Sharon.
I'm referring to Exhibit 9. It says the TDA has succeeded in raising the teachers' professions and talks about capacity, competitiveness, and capability, this one. Could you explain, you know, earlier you're talking about the number of teachers in the system being prepared are 55% more than is needed, I interpreted it this way, after 5 years. Even after 5 years with all the turnover and stuff, you're still preparing 55% more than is needed in the classroom. Did I understand that correctly? And then how does that relate to this capacity number here?
So let me just interpret this chart first. So we're preparing 4,200 teachers today across the 33 teacher preparation programs. We hire about 2,700 of them. And that, by the way, is if you assume that every teacher we hire goes to a Minnesota school. So that's not true. We know that's not true. So this is sort of a best case. And then 5 years later, 1,900 of those students, of those young people, are still teaching. So the 55 is the difference between the number we prepare and the number who are still in our classrooms 5 years later. What happened in the UK was a little bit different. They had two problems. We only have one. They weren't preparing enough teachers. at the time that this started. So what this chart is trying to say is that they actually, over this time period, they increased the number of teachers by 8%. So that's just the gross number of teachers in the country. But what's really interesting is that those graduating from the top schools went up 93%, and those graduating with the top degrees, they grade their degrees A, B, and C. So those graduating with the top degrees went up 75%. And that's the big move to quality. The total number of teachers in the country didn't really change that much, but the number of teachers, the share of teachers coming from the top colleges or coming with the top degrees just took off. And as Senator Pappas asked, the consequence was better reading scores, better math scores. And now today, the most interesting statistic, we just heard this, is in the United Kingdom today, half of all the newly graduating teachers are people changing careers to go into teaching. Mm. So experienced, mature folks who aren't taking a gamble so much, they kind of know who they are, and they're, I think it's like 52% of the new teaching graduates are people changing careers, and that's because they aggressively marketed teaching as a career. Again, something we've really not done much on, and it's something that Susan and I are working really hard on, launching a marketing campaign in Minnesota.
I understand Tom Rukavina has a really creative marketing person. Did I say? Yeah. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hutchinson or Ms. Hegard, does Exhibit 5 suggest that are we training an overabundance of teachers? And the discrepancy, I'm wondering what we know about that gap of, so we've trained you to be a teacher, you're not a newly hired teacher, what happens to you?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, Peter may jump in here too, but part of the response, I think, is that the discrepancy is that we're producing, it's the supply and demand point that I brought up earlier. Too many elementary teachers, not enough special ed teachers, not enough ESL teachers, not enough math and science teachers. So there's a mismatch built in here as well.
And Senator Pappas.
Senator Sharon.
Can I draw a conclusion that when you're talking about what you're paying for with the money that we're spending, and how the money flows, I think is a term that you used, was that we're paying for volume or credits and not outcomes, I might say, and that we're not targeting our acceptance into the programs based on those things that you were just talking about, where the need is in improvement whether they're special ed teachers or math teachers or chemistry teachers or art teachers, that we're not analyzing where the need is and then limiting enrollment based on that. Plus, we're rewarding volume over decisions being made on these other criteria.
Madam grasp Chair, that correctly? Senator Sharon, that's
Senator
correct.
And Ms. Hegard.
The two deans here, I think, would say part of what they're looking at is in their partnerships that they're building, you know, with their K-12 districts and schools, they're going to know very well what the needs are in those districts, and they're going to be able to train and tailor their program to the needs of the districts and schools that they're working with.
Mr. Hutchinson.
So these are two really great questions. So one of the things that you would be able to do if you went to something like this design is first statewide but also locally start to anticipate needs. And this TDA-like agency could actually say, we're only going to pay for STEM-related teachers, or we're only going to pay for ESL, which we don't do today. We don't. It's a guessing game to some extent, and the guessers are the students, the young people going into teaching, and they shouldn't have to guess. We actually could design a system in this state in which the K-12 systems are talking so frequently to the higher eds that you could anticipate 4 or 5 years out what kind of teacher you're going to need and maybe even what school they're going to teach in, and start producing the right number of teachers with the right skills at the right level of quality. with the investment we currently have.
So since we're on Exhibit 8, the comparison to how Minnesota funds it, first of all, we don't fund individual universities. Since we have the merger, we fund the University of Minnesota, the Board of Regents, and we fund MinSCU, the Board of Trustees, and then they dole it out from there. The university, do they just have two teacher ed schools, just Duluth and the University of Minnesota? Morris also has a teacher ed school? Okay. And then what did you say in the MinSCU system? There's 36?
MinSCU, there's seven.
Oh, there's seven. Where did I get 36?
33
in the whole state.
Oh, okay. So MinSCU has seven. And how many are in the pilot?
We have four of the MinSCU universities.
Are in your pilot.
In the Bushwork.
Okay, so the ones that are not would be?
Southwest.
Bemidji.
And Metro.
And Metro.
And Moorhead is part of a consortium, but the other three are standalones.
Okay. Moorhead is part of it. So how does, in your, not your proposal, but in this model, how do you envision the dollars flowing, the state dollars flowing? Because we're also, the private colleges are kind of a different system, because they only receive money from the state through either their tax benefits or through student financial aid.
So you would have lots of options. Let me describe one and then maybe some variations on it. So the legislature, so you're over on that side, might say, we want to dedicate the $60-plus million that are flowing into teacher preparation today, and we're going to create some entity to decide which programs are most likely to give us the number of teachers we need at the doing the kind of teaching we want at the level of quality that we expect. And so one version of this would be to say to the teacher preparation programs, all of them. So you would never want to limit this to the programs we're working with. To all the teacher preparation programs, bring us your best offer. You know, we're looking for 600 STEM teachers and, I'm making this up, and 400 ESL teachers and so on. Bring us your best offer. Tell us what you can do. And then that agency would choose to fund those people who made them the best proposition, and regardless of where that proposition came from. Now, the programs we're working with, we're going to be, you know, pushing on them to be successful where there's such an opportunity, but no guarantees, because I think what you want is, if you were to go down this road, is to make sure that agency has the freedom to get the best from whoever can produce that best product for you. Now, one of the things that's essential to make this work, this is the question Senator Rieger is asking, is you will need to have that performance information. How are those teachers that are being prepared by those programs doing? How much growth are they producing for their students? You know, are they closing the gaps? And one of the other issues that I think you're going to need to grapple with if you choose to go down this road is to make sure that connection is tight. From student achievement to teacher, from teacher to preparing institution. And you would expect this organization to have access to that information before it makes decisions about where to allocate those resources. Now, of course, you could narrow the scope of the programs that would be allowed to participate. You could broaden the scope of the programs that would be allowed to participate. That's obviously a policy decision that you all would want to make. But that's basically what the flow would be, that you would say as a body, we're prepared to commit X number of dollars to teacher preparation and expect that an agency would see to it that those dollars were producing the right teachers doing the right things at the right quality level and report back regularly on whether they're generating those teachers.
Since we already have almost a totally unified system, couldn't MinSCU do this rather than, you know, what's the advantage of setting up a separate bureaucracy, if you will, in these difficult times where we're cutting back on bureaucracy, set up a separate public agency?
I believe that the advantage the UK saw, because they also had multiple systems, was to make sure that every preparation program started out on an equal footing and that they had freedom to choose between and among all the programs that are out there, public, private, different university systems, different parts of the country, to get the result they were looking for.
Did they have a period of transition?
I think they did, but it wasn't very long. Mm-hmm. I think we all remember that Margaret Thatcher was a relatively impatient person, and she moved to this basic idea very quickly, and then the Blair government essentially put it on steroids and said,
of a top-down system, which is different.
It was very top-down in the UK.
Would you anticipate that some of the current teacher ed programs would, the college would decide no longer to have that program? I mean, we are in an era as we move into the next biennium where some programs are going to be phasing out just because there isn't going to be enough money.
I think there'd be two things that any preparation program would want to consider. The first was whether they could attract students in the first place. So if they couldn't attract the students, they'd have a very hard time competing. And then secondly, would they be able to produce, did they feel they could produce the quantity and the quality that the state would be looking for? And obviously every program would have to make their own decision about that.
Sure. Senator Latz.
Well, on that line, and to follow up on Senator Lynch's comment, we're over-preparing by 50% the number of teachers that are hired in Minnesota. So unless our goal is to publicly fund teacher preparation for states outside of Minnesota, sounds like we got overcapacity in our educational system.
Well, I think
I'm misreading this.
This has been kind of a something that has annoyed me for, like, 15 years. But the reality is, I mean, these students are still going to be in college. They're still going to be being educated. They just might not be in a teacher ed program. And also, like lawyers or any of us who have our backgrounds, there are other things you can do with a teaching degree that isn't necessarily in the classroom. It can help you be a better parent, you know, for one. But I do think you're right. If that these students end up leaving the state, that's not a good thing. You know, we want to keep them in the state.
Madam Chair, I would think most people who go to law school plan to practice law, but there are plenty who don't. They think they're going to business or something else, but they would find the law degree helpful. I would anticipate most people who seek a teaching degree probably plan to become teachers,
mm-hmm.
And aren't using it as a stepping stone into the business world or something else, because
right.
the training is so unique, I would think, and focused.
Good point.
But I don't know. That's not an evidence-based comment. That's just an instinct.
Right.
Intuition, I guess.
Before we move off this topic, and certainly we can take more questions, as long as we have the two deans from St. Cloud and from Winona, I would love if you would come forward and just make a few comments maybe on what's happening and how you see this proceeding in the future for your programs. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but it's all right. You're deans. You can handle it.
Go, Glenn.
Please introduce yourselves for the tape.
I'm Glenn Palm. I'm the interim dean at St. Cloud State University.
Welcome.
I'm Sally Staniford. I'm dean of the College of Education at Winona State.
And it was Sally
Standiford.
Standiford, thank you. Welcome. So thank you for you've been called courageous. Thank you for your courage. And so never difficult. Change is never easy.
Correct. Madam Chair and Senators, I didn't know I was going to be here until yesterday afternoon. Being part of the Bush Initiative, and I came in as a new dean on July 1st, and the Bush Initiative started on June 25th. So it's been taking up a lot of my time and energy. And for us, it opens up as sort of an exciting opportunity for us to really look at our teacher preparation program at a time when we need to think more carefully about how we're preparing our teachers. The framework that you had laid out for you of looking from all the way from recruiting teachers to preparing them to supporting them really gives us a much broader way of thinking about the preparation of teachers. I come from child development. For me, it's a developmental perspective that says instead of trying to cram as much as you can into 2 years in preparing teachers, their junior and senior year and getting them out and doing student teaching, we really have an opportunity to think about recruiting them and getting them started earlier in field placements to find out, is this something that they really want to do? One of the things that wasn't mentioned was there's a fair amount of attrition when people decide maybe I want to be a teacher to actually the people who finish the 4 years. But then after they graduate and finish student teaching successfully, we actually can follow them up for a couple of years, which is something we haven't done in the past, and really continue to support them during a critical transition for teachers into the school system. So for me, as a dean looking at our program and what we can do and what the Bush Foundation has sort of offered us, really gives us an opportunity to look at what we're doing very differently and to partner with schools in a different way. I was at a school board meeting last week, and not a school board meeting, it was a community meeting with the school board in St. Cloud. And, you know, everybody wants to sort of we want to blame, as institutions of higher education, the K-12 system, because kids come to us and they're not prepared in math. They have to take remedial math in college or writing. And then people want to blame colleges of education because you haven't prepared the teachers, and that's, you know, so we have this vicious cycle. I think this opens an opportunity for us to really be partners and understand that we're all invested, in the same that you are, in having our children with positive educational outcomes.
And are you partnering with high schools? Have you chosen the high schools you're going to partner with yet?
We've talked to a number of schools. We haven't made it's one of the things we're looking at is what is the criteria for partnering and who will make the best partners. So, yes, we have probably.
And where are highly effective teachers most needed?
we have looked at that. In fact, one of the first things we did was ask our superintendents, what kinds of teachers do you need? Who have you hired during the last 3 years? And just as you've heard, we have more elementary teachers than we need are produced. And we can't produce enough science, math, and special ed teachers.
Mm-hmm. And did you want to ask the dean a question? Okay, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you comment, knowing that we're having difficulty filling those niches, to what degree are we working with those students either before they enlist in the program or as they're making their selections? Do we need to do more in that area to sort of redirect students into the areas that we need so that they're able to get those jobs and they're not the students that are falling off the curve there because they're all elementary teachers or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that if
okay.
I can.
From
Winona State, we're thank you, Madam
Chair.
Just
introduce yourself to the tape. Just say your name again for the tape.
Sally Standiford. Thank you. We're a very proud tradition at Winona State. We're the oldest teacher preparation institution in the state, 150 years old, and we're looking forward to the next 150 with this wonderful investment by the Bush Foundation. We have been, for the last few years, a rather traditional education program, very successful, high quality, but we have essentially one pathway through the institution. And over the years, we have developed caps in various programs admitting students based on convenience for us and capacity in our local schools for student teaching placements rather than on the actual needs necessarily in the institution and anticipating them ahead of time. This particular investment gives us an opportunity, as Dean Potts said, to work with our school districts differently. We're working particularly with the Rochester, the Winona, and the La Crescent school districts, and looking at exactly the issue that you're raising. We are also carving out three different pathways rather than one. We have a pathway in Rochester, which is very sensitive to the community needs. In the last year, they have redesigned their teacher preparation program, which is completely a transfer program, only the upper 2 years, in conjunction with their school partners, but business partners, agency involvement, parents, and the like, to redesign what they're doing. And they're developing semester themes around the kinds of issues that you're talking about today so that every teacher that's prepared is well-versed and literate in STEM. in ethnography of language and global issues and the like, in addition to the kind of specialties that they will then graduate with. In Winona, we have an opportunity right now to sort of turn that on its head and go from what has been a traditional upper division program where students come in at the end of their sophomore year or their beginning of their junior year to doing a residential college as the primary draw to the students and beginning their teacher education program right off the bat as incoming freshmen, building on the same kind of model that Rochester has put forward, but around the community issues that our students will face. And so our faculty are developing, along with the school partners, the kinds of themes that all of our students, not just elementary, but all students should have. And then finally, we're trying to do late recruiting. So we have a number of students that come to our institution. They're very qualified, would make wonderful teachers, but have never thought about that. And generally, in the past, when they get to their junior year or their senior year, it's too late for them to become a teacher because they don't want to have to start over. And so one of the things that we're able to do here is to design a very fast-track program that builds on the experiences that they've had and translates them to the kind of skills and opportunities that they'll need in order to develop their teaching skills.
Any other questions?
Madam
Great.
Chair?
Senator Wicker.
Thank you. Madam Chair, there's, like all fields, great faculty, sometimes not as great. This presupposes in training highly effective teachers that you have great faculty. Just give us reassurance of that, and I suppose you do the evaluation of that.
Yes. Dean Pod.
Madam Chair and Senator, yes. Actually, I see this as an opportunity to push our faculty in their own development in terms of being able to look at and model and think about the outcomes of our students in the same way that we want our teachers to think about them and be connected to them. So in that sense, I think it's a wonderful opportunity for faculty development. And yes, I stayed up late last night doing tenure and promotion recommendations, so those are hard decisions, and we try and certainly recruit faculty who are best. I think the other opportunity that we actually have is to do some partnering with schools in different ways so that some of the best teachers also come into our classrooms and some of our faculty spend more time out in the schools, which I think is a recipe for raising the quality of our faculty.
Senator Roblings.
But as a follow-up, would the best faculty be looked at as the best researchers or writers of doc papers, findings, or persons that can raise test scores for students, ultimately, that are trained?
Yeah, what's the basis for...
good question. We have a range of them. When I think about, and I've been at St. Cloud State for 25 years as a faculty member. I've been a dean for 6 months. So when I look at faculty members at St. Cloud State and think about them, they come there mainly for their love of teaching, the best ones. And that's what they do well. We certainly have some people who are able to do some good applied research, but people come there because they love to teach. If you love to teach, what do you think the people who are under you are going to learn?
Senator Roebling.
And Madam Chair, my question, if somebody has more questions for these testifiers, they can go ahead.
Back
because
to the
mine
bush.
May be for...
Are there any other questions for our surprise guests? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming up and down to St. Paul. Is this for Ms. Higard or Mr. Hutchinson or either?
Thank you. My question would be, I really applaud you for what you're doing. I think it's marvelous that our goal is to have better trained teachers. One of my concerns, though, is with what is happening in our economy right now, as teachers are being laid off, it will be the new ones. And that's a huge concern. And then we have teachers who may not be as effective who are in there right now, and they'll be there for the next 30 to 40 years, potentially. Have you looked at how we can make current teachers more effective in the classroom? or how did you decide to focus just on the new ones?
Mr. Hutchinson.
I'd love to tell you it was some deep philosophical debate. We just felt that, first of all, we're lucky. We get to have a 10-year perspective. We can think really long-term. We know it's a recession. We know bad things are going on. We don't think it's going to last forever. So we're able to take a really long-range view. And when we realized that over the course of that decade, half of all the teachers that are currently in our classrooms will leave teaching for one reason or another, mostly for retirements, it just felt like that's the place we ought to focus our attention. And we did. And that's what we've done. We've not focused, literally not focused any attention on what could or could not be done with the other 25,000 that are still going to be there. If we're successful with the first 25,000, maybe we'll focus our attention on the other. But we are what we are. We can only do so much, and our board and our staff kind of feel like 25,000 is as much as we can handle it at this moment in time.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think we just kind of touched the tip of the iceberg about the financing, but we'll have to have more discussions about that and with the systems and the powers that be, the committee, and we'll see how it goes. But
thank you very much,
and we appreciate your work. Thanks. Okay, next on our agenda, we have the Office of Higher Education with a couple reports.
Don't want to kill her.
It's pure. This one he has.
Madam Chair and members, I think we're set to go here. For the record, I am Mark Mishkanis with the Office of Higher Education. And with me is, of course, Tricia Grimes, who you will recognize from many times in front of you, and Alexander Durovich, who is the author of the two reports, and she'll do most of the presentation today. She's new in front of you.
Welcome to the committee.
So with that, I believe you do have the some reports with you in your packets. Mm-hmm. We do have a short presentation on both of these. One is on the participation rates. The second one is on enrollment. Just one comment before we get started. We had hoped, I guess, to get this enrollment data in front of you before the conversation last week on the state grant, because it would have been a nice prelude to that, because, of course, it's enrollment that's driving the cost of that program. But with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to Mr. Urich.
And could you say your name and especially your last name again for us?
Sure. Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Alexandra Jurovich from the Office of Higher Ed. And today I'll be discussing two higher education topics. They will be the college participation rates and enrollments in Minnesota post-secondary institutions. What are participation rates? Participation rates measure the college-going activity of high school graduating classes. And they're calculated by dividing the number of students who graduate from Minnesota High School by the number who enter college the next fall. And the Office of Higher Education has been calculating the college participation rates of Minnesota High School graduates since 1991. And why we look at participation rates, because they're a measure of the major transition point.
Just a minute. Senator Wieger?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, just a clarification. College is any post-secondary?
Oh, yeah, I just use college just because it's shorter.
Okay.
And it fits on post-secondary institutions. Just,
okay.
Yeah. So it means any post-secondary activity after high school.
Okay.
Right.
Military service?
No. No. Just so it is a post-secondary institution, okay. But not non-military, right?
Okay.
They train you.
Thank you.
You get a special.
They're important because they're one of the major transition points on the education pathway from K-12 to a higher education credential in the workforce. And participation rates are an indicator of college access and student choice. And they also gauge whether post-secondary education is accessible to a broad socioeconomic range of high school graduates. Since 1996, this is just a graph of the participation rates. What we can do is we can track the students who are enrolled in a Minnesota post-secondary institution, and then using a different data source, we kind of tag on those enrolled out of state. And so since 1996, the total participation of students going in-state or out-of-state has increased from 56% to 70.2% now in 2008, which is the highest rate. So what this really says is 70% of Minnesota high school graduates are going to college immediately after high school graduation.
And Ms. Jurevich, you're only till 2008, so our indications are we have another upswing over this last year.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So really the message is out there. You know, Minnesota students do want to go on to college, and they do go to college. Obviously, you know, whether they're completing college and that type, that's another whole other topic of discussion. But this is just you know, saying, so there is an indication, and the message is out there, you know, and students are actually, you know, adhering to that message. So this middle line shows that in the last five years at least, about 50% of the Minnesota high school graduates have been enrolling in a Minnesota institution, but the rate enrolling out of state has just increased somewhat.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So what we don't know is the 30% who do not go on to college right away. You know, some might be choosing the military. Or just, you know, delaying their college or doing other, you know, activities, going to work. This chart just shows the most recent comparisons to see how participation rates in Minnesota compare nationally and around the state. There's data here for 2004 and 2006. There just isn't 2008 comparisons, but Minnesota does fairly well. And the percent of high school graduates attending college compared to the nation and other states. Of the 2008 high school graduates in Minnesota,
Senator Babb, just a minute, Senator Sharon.
Would you go back to that last slide? Of the top three states on the left side are the states that have the highest percent of high school graduates going directly to college. And you're saying that Minnesota is fifth at 63.3%. But I thought in an earlier conversation you said 70% of our high school graduates.
Oh, that's because this is 2004 data. Because the state and national comparison only was from other years. So the years aren't meshing. Unfortunately, the 2008 data won't be available probably. It lags because this is coming from a national data set.
But your 2006 data does have Minnesota up at 68%. That's on the right, right?
Yep.
But dropping in ranking.
Yeah.
Right. So it's hard to tell where we're going to rank, mm-hmm. you know, in the different years. But what this is just showing is like what some of the top states are in the nation. And this peer state... this was done for another report, and we picked a certain set of peer states for that report.
Madam Chair, this is from our accountability report, so the peer states are the same as in that report.
Very interesting, this comment about Mississippi. Did mm-hmm. people see that?
Mm-hmm. This next slide shows, it's just, you know, just to show where the students who choose to stay in Minnesota, what are the top institutions. So of those who go to college, 72% will attend a Minnesota institution. And, of course, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities is the number one, with Mankato second and so forth. And this next slide is comparable to show of those who went to college, 28% enrolled out of state in 2008, and these are the top 15 out-of-state institutions attended. And, of course, they are border states on the two major institutions in North Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa. This slide graphs the whole country, and it just shows that, you know, Minnesota high school graduates really tend to stay close to home. And even of those who went out of state, 66% attend institutions in one of Minnesota's border states, Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, or North Dakota. And this is just to show all the different states where they attend. And for 2008, there was a high school graduate attending one or more post-secondary institution in every state in the United States. And where we get, out of curiosity, where we get the out-of-state data is a survey that is done by the U.S. Department of Education. They ask every post-secondary institution of their new entering students who graduated within the last 12 months, what state is their home state? Another aspect of college participation that the Office of Higher Education tracks is the extent different racial ethnic groups participate in college. Data collected on students enrolling out of state, we don't know their race ethnicity because that data only asks what state they come from. So just looking at Minnesota students, you'll see that, you know, the different characteristics. You know, Asian students have the highest college participation rates. Participation of black students actually in Minnesota has been increasing the last couple of years, but American Indian and Hispanic students lag behind other groups. And this slide actually shows then of those students by race ethnicity, the types of Minnesota institutions that they're attending. Black students, so black high school graduates, are more likely to enroll in a Minnesota community and tech college than other groups. But Asian students in Minnesota are more likely to enroll at the University of Minnesota. I mean, so there's no quality issues here, but it's just interesting to track this type of thing because people who look at race ethnicity like to see, are there any differences in the types of institutions they're attending besides whether they're actually attending college?
Could you go back one slide? I just got behind you.
Sure.
It's very interesting. So so it shows that black students who graduate, 49% of them are going to college, and of white students who graduate, 50% are going to college. That's amazing.
Right. And there has been a trend in the last few years for Minnesota to see a large uptick in the black participation. Mm-hmm. You know, and unfortunately, we just code them by whether they're African-American. We've been trying to, there's a large Somali population and African-born from Africa.
And they're in that category.
Right.
So
but
this,
we don't know.
This could be more immigrants.
You know.
In other words, going to college in that black category.
You know, it's just been a hypothesis of mine. And people who work at Minnesota institutions have noticed that, especially within the Twin Cities, Minneapolis Community Tech College, Normandale, they kind of say if you walk around the halls, it looks like, just tons of, Somali background, African background students. And, those usually new immigrant groups, value, mm-hmm. Higher education for their children.
I'm just thinking about the class I teach from Metro State right now. I have six black students. Three are African-American and three are African, from Somalia, from Ethiopia, and from another country. Can't think of what it is. Interesting.
Senator Pappas.
Yes, Senator Sharon.
I don't know if this is the logic flows, but in the graph about Mississippi having the lowest high school graduation rates, but of those who graduate, a very high percentage going on, this graph would indicate that there may be a low high school graduation rate for this population, but of those who graduate, very high percentage going on. So it's something there is a similar dynamic.
Exactly,
we do have a lower graduation rate of blacks.
Right, Madam Chair. And yes, I did forget to indicate that is true in Minnesota. I actually don't know the high school graduation rate, but it's very low for African, for students who are classified as black. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's possibly the same, thing happening here, that we do have a lot who do not graduate. It's very low, especially in the urban area, Twin Cities, very low high school graduation for African Americans, black, students. So that's possibly the same thing happening here.
But Madam Chair?
Yes.
I do have the 2005 for Minnesota. Black, 38.8% graduate in Minnesota. Mm. Hispanic, 41.9%. And American Indian, 40.5%.
And the white graduation rate is like?
This.
97% or something.
And this is 83.3, but there's different ways of how it's categorized. But clearly there's a huge achievement gap, which I guess is the hugest in the country, Minnesota.
Well, actually, I'm Madam Chair and Senators. So my topic on participation is actually finished. Actually, that last slide. So are there, do you have any more, am I going the wrong
way? You're going the wrong way.
No. So do you have any more questions on participation?
Well, you mentioned that black students were more likely to enroll in Minnesota's community technical colleges and Asian students more likely to enroll at the U of M.
Right. Well, now I'm moving to our second topic, which isn't 100% related to the first topic, but this is just another report that we did recently where we track the what the headcount enrollment is this last fall. So the current academic year we're in. And data for this report, just comes from Minnesota Post-Secondary Institutions. And it's data they sent to our office to populate our student enrollment database. For this particular report, I do this early in the fall. So if data are not received in time, I do call the registrar's office and just say, how many students do you currently have enrolled? The Minnesota State Universities and Colleges provide an early fall census for the preliminary fall headcount, and that's one of their official reports that they produce in October. So this data is actually from October, so the fall 2009 headcount. And it shows that in both Minnesota's public and private colleges, universities, and career schools, there were over 372,000 students enrolled. And that's undergraduates and graduates, just the total number of people enrolled in our institutions. And this enrollment increased 5.3% over 2008. There actually were 18,000 more students enrolled than last year. Over the last 5 years, here's like the enrollment trend. The state universities, University of Minnesota, and four-year institutions are they're all bunched together. They're all essentially the same enrollment. But 89% of the actual growth in Minnesota's institutions have actually occurred at the two-year institutions, the public community and tech colleges and the private career schools. These two sectors increased by 16,000 students from last year. So of the 18,000, 16,000, there were just more of them at the two-year institutions. And here's, instead of the line graph, here's the actual numbers of students. So there were 10,000 more students at community and tech colleges from 2009 to the previous year, 2,000 more at the state universities, Unfortunately, I can't see whether these are undergraduates or graduates, but there were just 2,000 more at state universities. 1,000 more students were enrolled at the University of Minnesota. The private colleges, their enrollment was the same. And that's actually, that hasn't happened for a while. They've been sort of going up incrementally every year a little bit, but this is the first year it's been about the same. And there were 5,000 more students at the private career schools. And that really is about, there's really about five private career schools that contributed to that growth. There would be Rasmussen colleges, and that's because they are enrolling more students, but they're opening more campuses around the state. And the same thing with the Minnesota School of Business and Globe. They're doing the same thing. They're opening more campuses, and every campus has more students. And there's about three other institutions that contribute to that private career growth.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, on this chart, I think it might be helpful for us. The last columns that are noting those changes might be something that we want to keep in mind as we move forward and we are making allocations and decisions on where our state grant dollars are going to flow. This is providing some pretty good information about perhaps where the need is most prevalent.
So, Madam Chair and Senators, I'm actually done with my presentation. So if you have any other questions about either one of these topics.
So these other handouts that we have are is just more information of what you've already presented.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, that one, is that the prelim headcount? Yes. Yeah, that has every institution. So you can see the five-year trend for each institution.
Oh, I see. Oh, good.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Wieger.
Question, did you have a chance just to compare nationally for the different categories as to these trends? Is it consistent or anything that's different that is remarkable?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, actually, this last year, it has gone up a lot. Nationally, they are seeing a large enrollment growth at community colleges, community and or tech colleges, you know, in the United States and different states. So it's very similar. I think the private colleges, they just tend to hold their own because many of them aren't looking to grow. They're just looking to maintain. You know, if they have so many, you know, freshman slots, they just want to fill those slots. But there has been, a large uptick, and they're finding it's been at the same type of institutions, community and tech colleges, however they're structured in different states, and also the private career sector.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. I know you're just presenting headcount information here, but there must be some discussion within your department and your policy analysts. So can you give us some of your thinking about what you think is behind the trend changes? You know, some of us here would probably think it's related to the economy, and people are laid off. And like businesses, if they're using this downtime to invest in themselves, so when the economy turns around, they'll be better positioned for better jobs. What's your internal discussion?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think it's both. You know, it's possible, you know, because we're seeing it at the community and tech college area, that it could be people who, you know, are looking to, you know, retrain themselves. But also another aspect is just because the economy is low and people don't have enough money, that people might be at, until I can do an analysis later, are these like new high school graduates who are now choosing to go to a cheaper option, a community college, instead of paying, you know, the family, you know, just can't, you know, what they're saying, you know what, started at a two-year institution. Because what I've noticed, it's not the tech colleges. Like, I know it's hard now with MinSCU because the community college, you know, some are still called tech colleges and they're more tech colleges. Like, for Dakota County Tech, their enrollment really didn't go up that much. So I'm thinking, okay, and I was looking at the ones in the metro area that are, you know, have a community college name. Unfortunately, some were mergers, like Century was a tech college, but those have gone up a lot. You know, so I'm wondering if those students aren't just choosing to attend the 2 year first and then you know, just to save money. Mm-hmm. So there could be a combination of both happening.
Ms. Jurevich, there's this chart that we have, participation rates by racial ethnic background, that was passed out. And there's columns on the top with years and ethnic groups. And then about halfway down, there you repeat all the years. And I'm not quite sure what this means.
Oh, yes. Well, that's, oh, I'm not, because instead of having it go landscape, it's so, this is the black, these are the different groups. So it's just so it fits on a 8.5 by 11.
Well, what different groups? We've got black, American, Indian, Asian, Hispanic.
Oh, it probably doesn't show.
Is this white?
So then, you know why? Because there's like a gap there. So the second half, it's total students of color. So it, so that first.
This is total students of color.
Right.
And then it's white students and then total. Oh, okay.
Right.
I see. So there's like a line here.
Right.
And this is continued over here.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then so what, you know, what you can see is that participation rate, that actual number, just fluctuates so much from year to year. You know, especially with some of these race ethnicities, because the NES are the number of new freshmen. Mm-hmm. And that number is, you know, changes. Though it has been going up, the actual number of those students of color have been going up. But because there are more high, you know, students of color who are graduating from Minnesota high schools, that number is going up every year.
Mm-hmm.
I think currently the number of new high school graduates is about who are students of color is about 16%. And that just, you know, has been going up. But it'll probably be easily 20% and, you know, not too
so
long.
The fact that overall there are more students of color could also influence that. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're doing a better job graduating them or getting them into college. It's just there's more students.
Well, it's also based on a rate. So even though there are more of them,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are more going to college too. So it's you know, so it is based on, you know, it's dividing the number of high school graduates based on the number who are in a Minnesota college,
mm-hmm.
who have indicated what high school they graduated from.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. One of the things we noticed in those who filled out a financial aid application, and there was a big increase in the number who filled out a financial aid application this year, is that there was a particular increase in students from families with incomes under 50,000
mm-hmm.
enrolled all over the
right.
state,
I
which is
that.
Part of what created the demand for the state grant
right.
program. And in the long run for the state, this is a very good thing. You get more of those low-income students getting the kind of education that will enable them to earn better wages in the future. But in the short term, it helps contribute to our shortfall in the state grant program.
Right. Okay. Thank
sure.
you. Senator Wenger.
We're almost done here. But
okay.
Madam Chair, it looks like there's 372,000 and change that attend Minnesota schools of all type. Do you know about what percentage of that would be Minnesota residents?
Madam Chair,
Chair
Senator, Hitch. It's about 85%. The actual percent from kind of stays the same. The number has gone up, like everything. The actual numbers have gone up, but the percentage is about for undergraduates. It's been about 85% for the last 10 years. So we have about the same like percentage who are out of state, though the numbers.
550. Okay, and Madam Chair, I saw University of Phoenix. Has a campus in Minneapolis, and it's growing. Just any comments about the expansion of online, particularly by other competitors, and what's being done by Minnesota schools? I don't know if you track that as closely, but.
Madam Chair and Senator Wager, certainly we've been looking at it not as closely as we probably should. I mean, our observation is it's growing by leaps and bounds. I noticed that Craig Shonick was in here earlier. I'm not sure he's still here, but I think that much of the MNSCU growth this past year has been in online courses.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly with as Phoenix comes to town, so to speak, they have to register with us, and we see all their new program offerings, and they are expanding the program offerings dramatically as well.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes.
If I could follow up, for example, I had a conversation with President Winia from North Hennepin Community College, and she said that they have quite a few classes now that they consider hybrid classes, where 1 week they meet in the classroom and the next week they meet online. Mm-hmm. And so they're actually able to schedule two classes for the same space at the same time. But that quite a bit of their growth was either in completely online classes or classes that were partly online, partly in the classroom.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Ms. Grimes, when they have a presence in Minnesota, so if the University of Phoenix has established a state presence, then all of their students are eligible for state grants too?
Madam Chair, if they're enrolled at one of the University of Phoenix campuses in Minnesota and their enrollment is attributed to that campus, then they would, and they're a Minnesota resident, they would be eligible for a state grant. Phoenix is an interesting case because some of their online enrollment is attributed to Arizona. Arizona's production of bachelor's degrees, for example, looks huge compared to their population, partly because much of University of Phoenix's enrollment all over the country ends up getting attributed to Arizona. Mm. But if they're attributed to one of the Minnesota campuses of University of Phoenix and they're a Minnesota resident, then they are eligible for state grant.
Madam Chair.
Well,
do you think that's why some of them have established, bases here so that the students would be eligible for state grants?
Ms.
Jurevich?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator. Actually, though, they would only be eligible if they're an undergraduate, and a lot of University of Phoenix courses in Minnesota are graduate programs. So this data has undergraduate and graduate. So University of Phoenix does not have very many students enrolled in undergraduate programs. And when I get data from some of those type of providers, DeVries, another one, I ask them to only report students who are Minnesota residents who are taking a course, through our Minnesota, one of their Minnesota campuses. So these really are not, national students.
I'm looking at your insight chart on the front page of this handout that you gave us. And I think you showed us these charts in just a little different form. So I'm less encouraged when I look at this. It's 2008, so it doesn't show the 2009 increase, which was 5% or something you said. But it pretty much says that our in-state enrollment is really stable, 50%, that most of the growth took place from 96 to 2001, where we went from 41% to 50%. We've been kind of hovering around 50%. But the recent increase in the last 5 or 6 years has been out-of-state enrollment. But that sounds like that's primarily Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota. They've been attracting more students.
Madam Chair, yes, but that's not a bad thing. Part of it also could be just better reporting because, like I said earlier, that information where we collect out-of-state students who go out-of-state are from a different data source, mm-hmm. So we need to cobble the two together. Mm-hmm. But it's just a good thing. I mean, these are usually those going out-of-state are from higher income brackets, obviously, because they can, afford all the other expenses that entail, living away from home and far from home. But yes, and it probably has, and they do tend to just stay around our neighboring states.
Yeah, I don't have a problem them going to out of state. I'm just wondering what that means in terms of our overall goal of increasing students going to college. And it may be that if we have the higher income students that are starting to go to that are going to out of state colleges, then there may very well be an increase in our in state enrollment. They're just supplanting others. It's kind of hard to interpret that. Not quite sure how to interpret that. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
I'm sure we'll see you again. I don't know about Ms. Jurevich. It was very nice of you to come and present to us.
Anyway.
Oh, Greg Schoenecker from Minsky Research. I didn't ask him. He's in the back.
It's the institute located in the state.
Yes, it's in statute located.
Mr. Schoenecker, did you have anything you wanted to add? I haven't quite adjourned the meeting yet.
I know.
And I just had a note that you were here.
Could make a couple of comments.
Any interpretations
responding to
of
some
what's
of the questions earlier. For the record, I'm Craig Schenecker, System Director for Research with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We looked a bit more deeply into our enrollment increases this fall. Last fiscal year, fiscal year 2009 compared to the previous year, 2008, we had an overall enrollment in credit courses, an increase of about 4%, but saw that tide start to turn. In the summer of 2009, our enrollment increase over the previous summer was 9%. This most recent fall semester, the overall increase was 7%, but I think some of the breakdowns will give you some insights into who that population of students is that we're seeing come to our colleges and universities. Probably the most significant differential is if we look at the age distribution. Students of traditional college age up to 24, increase of that population was about 3%, and the increase of students 25 and over was 14% this fall. So we're seeing an influx of adults. Something that goes along with that is Pell eligibility and Pell grant recipient status. The number of our students fall semester 2009 who received a Pell grant increased by 33% compared to the previous fall. So of these students coming in, a large percentage of them are eligible for Pell grants. Students of color are up about 15% this fall over last fall. Another pattern that's a bit different from what we've been seeing over the years is the increase for male students was 8% compared to 5% for female students. We've seen a little bit higher growth of male students recently, but we're still, as a system, predominantly female enrollment, about 60-40, about 59-41, something like that, predominantly women enrolled. And I guess the last thing I'd say is the pattern we're seeing in the very early numbers for spring semester look essentially very similar to fall. Larger than typical increases, more adult students, and also more larger increase in male students than female students.
Great. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Appreciate it. The committee is adjourned.